Welcome, everybody. This is Marla Spindell with DC Kin Care Alliance, and I'm here with my colleague Stephanie McClellan, and we're joined again with our special guest, Christian Green, for part three of our interview with her. Stephanie, did you want to talk a little bit about what we're going to address today?
Sure. Thanks, Marla. You know, last time we talked about the increase in child deaths and the need for an ombudsperson to address child issues in the district. And today we thought we'd look behind those numbers. What is CFSA doing? How are they acting to prevent abuse and neglect of DC's children? We know that it's very important to CFSA to reduce foster care numbers in the district. It's something they're proud of, that they tout on their website and in testimony before the council. So how are they acting to reduce those foster care numbers? How do they make the decision to remove a child and place the child in foster care or keep the child with their parents and have a safety plan in place to keep them in their home? When you look at CFSA's numbers on their website, the foster care numbers keep going down. For example, in June of 2018, the number of children in foster care was 833. It went up slightly to 850 in 2019. And then when you look at 2020, in June of this year, the number of children in foster care was 731 children. Now, does that reflect an actual reduction in the need for foster care, as CFSA says, or does that reflect that there are children out there who are being abused and neglected in need of services, specifically foster care, who aren't being served? So, Christian, what we thought we'd do is just have you, as our expert, walk us through what a decision to remove a child or keep that child in place with a safety plan looks like, what are the considerations, and how that decision is made. So, Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about how a decision is made whether or not to engage in a safety plan with parents to keep a child who might be at risk in the home, and when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate to do that?
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of want to start with the premise that Child and Family Service is a child servicing agency, meaning the laws are really written to determine whether or not a child has been abused or neglected. If that determination is made, the child, independent of what the world looks like around them, is entitled to resources, support, and mitigation of that abuse and neglect. So I want to be clear, just because a safety plan is put in place doesn't negate the government's responsibility to ensure that safety plan is really viable, that it meets the need of that particular child. And safety plans can be done in a wealth of different ways. The core factor of a safety plan is something that I would tell parents all the time, which is the easiest way to think about it. A safety plan can only be done when a parent is safe to plan with. So if I, as a social worker, have gone out into the community and interacted with an individual who is currently unsafe, then a safety plan at that moment cannot be conducted with that individual. So if you think about it as that being the premise, safety planning becomes much easier. So for instance, an unsafe parent to plan with would be someone who currently the mental health status is impacting their ability to parent the child. If the individual is under the influence, then they would be unsafe to plan with. If the individual was currently making threats or unwilling to be a part of the plan. So if I had a duty as a biological parent or a legal custodian to plan for this child's safety and unwilling to do anything, that would make them an unwilling caregiver and essentially become an unsafe parent. What I did was I created this chart that helps as a walkthrough. So this is based on my experience as a clinician, my 15 years in working in child welfare, and I will make the distinction that this safety planning flowchart is not representative of the policy that is currently published by CFSA. This is really how social workers are taught to assess for safety, and this is typically the thought pattern a social worker would go through. And in my experience as a social worker, this was also the legal threshold that we needed to meet in order to determine whether the child was safe in the home or removal. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
I wanted to also say my understanding, and I know you'll go into this more, Christian, that safety planning is supposed to be something that's a short-term type thing. It's not supposed to be something that goes on for months or years, which is sometimes what we see happening with safety plans. So I just wanted people to keep in the back of their minds what the purpose of a safety plan is, that it's supposed to be a short-term intervention to address an immediate problem. The safety plan would not be appropriate in a situation where it would take longer than a number of days or a few weeks to ameliorate the safety concern, or the safety concern has been attempted to be ameliorated in the past without success, which means that the parent is unable to accomplish the plan, and so therefore a safety plan would not be appropriate in that situation. And that's exactly when we see CFSA trying to get relatives to step in to take the child when they know that the child won't be safe in the home with the parent with any type of services. And they actually engage in safety planning to have the child live with that relative. As I said, a lot of times that goes on for months and years, and the social worker will even recommend that the relative go down and file for custody. If this is supposed to be a short-term fix to deal with an immediate safety problem that can be addressed in a short amount of time, why would a relative need to go down and get custody? And if a parent is agreeing to this, if the parent's safe and can agree, again, why would a relative have to go down to get custody unless the agency is trying to pursue a safety plan in a situation where they shouldn't be doing that?
Yeah. So safety plans should be time-limited, short-term plans that the government has an opportunity to put in services to mitigate whatever the safety concern is, because the goal is to keep the family whole in the community. Anytime the child welfare agency, who has a duty to protect, mentions custody. Custody is a very distinct court from that of child welfare. One should be on alert immediately, because if they are mentioning the need for a custody change, there's a clear indication of safety concerns that rise to the level of what we would call an immediate removal. And the state has a duty to conduct that immediate removal. So if a social worker is saying that you need to apply for custody as a condition of the safety plan, that is placing the state's duty back on the community and is not in line with their function. It should be very clear at that point in time the state has a duty to act, and then we can ask them, how are you going to mitigate this safety concern, given child welfare courts act very differently than custody courts.
Christian, did you want to go through the chart?
Okay, so the safety plan chart breaks it down by safety versus risk. Safety is an immediate safety concern that jeopardizes someone at that point in time. Risk are things that can be mitigated with support services and could pose an immediate safety concern in the future, but aren't really at that moment. So once a social worker says to you that a safety plan is needed, it means there's a safety issue that needs to be mitigated at that moment, because you don't do safety plans for long-term risk. The distinction would be, you have to make the first assessment. Is the parent safe or are they unsafe? If it's a safe parent and the parent understands the identified concerns and is willing to work for short-term resolution, then that's definitely a viable safety plan. If the parent is unable to come up with a safety plan and they're a safe parent, and you as social workers can supplement it with resources in the community, or maybe the child has a godparent on the other side that's like, yeah, come hang out for the weekend, and the parent consents and says, yeah, that's great, let's do that, and then we can all cool down, come back to the table and figure this out later, that's viable. If you have a safe parent who cannot make a safety plan and the social worker is unable to identify how to make it safe in that environment that is a removal. If you have a safe parent who does not understand the need for the safety plan but is willing to acknowledge everyone needs a little breath, I'll agree to the safety plan because it's in the best interest of my child, then it is a viable safety plan. But if you have a safe parent who doesn't understand the need, will not consent to a safety plan despite the fact that the social worker has identified it, then that would be a removal. Now, mind you, most safe parents will agree to some type of safety plan, and there's a distinction between safe parents who were also the alleged abuser versus safe parents who didn't conduct any abuse. So if I'm a safe parent who wasn't participating in the abusive behavior, it pretty much is the safety plan is them. So say mom is the abuser and dad is not. We can plan with dad because he would be technically the safety plan and he's the custodian as well. So there's other scenarios where you're trying to identify a safety plan with an unsafe parent. And I think it goes back to this. If you have the alleged abuser, the unsafe parent, you want to go to the second custodian or to the other biological parent to determine the legal validity of that and implement a safety plan. And with that situation, that other parent, that other caregiver is the safety plan. So they are the one implementing it and they don't need to recreate something else. If you have an unsafe parent who you can't conduct a safety plan with, that's a clear removal, and you don't have a secondary parent or anything. If you have an unclear legal relationship, you would start by trying to figure out if there is a legal relationship between the secondary parent, meaning is there a court order of some type, whether it be child support, custody court, things of that nature. If there is, then you can move forward with that other identified person. If there's no clear legal relationship, it's the government's duty to conduct a removal and then make the determination on behalf of the child. So for instance, often what you find with kin, they are in this situation of no legal relationship, and when they're put in that situation, they shouldn't be pressured into applying for custody, given the fact that it doesn't mitigate the immediate safety concerns. Bio parents or legal parents can come back and take the child back. What really should be happening is the agency saying, I can't make a viable safety plan, and because of that, I'm making the decision to intervene with a removal, and then I'm going to look at that third party as a potential licensed kinship home or a licensed home. And DC has the ability to expedite those within the district and in Maryland because there's an MOU in Maryland where typically they can get it done within 24 hours if it's a business day. So I think most of the things that we're talking about fall under you have an unsafe parent with someone with an unclear legal relationship or no legal relationship to the child. And according to practice and the way the law supports it, is that if the agency is going to make a placement decision, they only have the authority to make a placement decision after conducting a removal.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, because obviously we represent the relatives and we're getting involved when a relative is stepping in to take care of a child after there's an abuse or neglect allegation. What we've found is because CFSA seeks to ensure that their foster care numbers are going down, they try any possible way to back into the fact that they don't have to remove in that particular situation or even make a safety plan. For instance, if a relative takes the child after an abuse or neglect allegation, there are various ways we've seen the agency try to get out of having to take any responsibility for that situation, which includes they don't even investigate it in the first place, saying the child's safe with this relative. Even if they do investigate the allegation, they may not substantiate it. They may say, well, there's no safety issue here. We don't even need to make a safety plan or remove or do any of that because the child's already safe with a relative. Or maybe they'll substantiate the abuse or neglect, but again, say there's no ongoing risk because the child is safe with the relative. So in other words, they go outside of the chart that you're talking about. They don't even work within the context of that chart by saying certain things aren't happening, even if they are, so they don't have to go through all of these decision points in determining whether a safety plan is warranted and or whether removal is warranted. When agencies arrange for children to live with a relative when there's been abuse or neglect, and they don't go through those requirements to determine if there's a safety issue and how to ensure that everybody in that situation is safe, everyone's rights are intact, and that they all are able to either make decisions, or if the parent's not able to make a decision, that the relative that's taking custody of this child could make decisions for the child. People in the field call that kinship diversion or hidden foster care.
Historically, it's been called an illegal third-party placement. I testified to it a couple years in front of DC City Council, and essentially CFSA has been found to use that practice historically and were scolded for it and had to change practice. I came in at a point in time through CFSA where it was very clear the agency did not make third-party placements. Essentially, the definition of a third-party placement is when the agency is making the placement decision but coding it as a safety plan. But we have to be very clear that a safety plan is not a change in placement. It does not deal with custody. And so when people code a request for a custody change or a long-term change in placement as a safety plan, that's an improper use. Safety plans are used to mitigate safety concerns in the community for the betterment of the family. If you remove a child from that family, code it as a safety plan and do not provide resources to mitigate their original safety concern, you place the child in more danger than they were before because there's no legal parameters around that. And I, as the abuser, can go pick up my child or violate the safety plan at any point with only the threat of, well, if you violate, we'll do a removal. But then you get into this very weird space. Who are you removing from? Because you've essentially named somebody else acting in loco parentis. And what the agency will do is if there's a period of time that lapses from the initial safety plan and somebody who stepped in to fulfill essentially a placement role or custodian role within the context of a safety plan can no longer meet the child's needs because they're not receiving the financial, the legal guidance, the resources, something as simple as making sure that they're connected with mental health services. They get exhausted and they bring the child to the agency and say, I can no longer do this. And then the agency will tell them, well, if you don't do this, we'll substantiate you. So you get this very awkward residual effect where you have this individual who's trying to do the right thing, trying to safeguard the child, being put in an untenuous situation and legally binding them up in something. I think asking a kinship person to go apply for custody immediately starts that process because then the agency can say, well, custody was changed. This person is now responsible for everything. But that's not the way the law is written once a child is identified as abused or neglected.
And that's what we see all the time where the agency tells the relative to go file for emergency custody because they know the child isn't safe. And if they're not going to remove the child, the only way they can try to ensure that is to get the relative to go down to court and get a judge to order that it's an emergency and this child needs to be with the relative. But by doing that, they're basically shirking their own responsibilities to address the emergency and also giving legal advice to relatives about how they should be addressing the issue when the CFSA should be addressing the issue. We actually have two federal lawsuits now in DC District Court dealing with these exact issues and violations of law and policy. both federal and state laws that we believe are violated when CFSA does this. On our website, you can go into our publications tab if you want to learn more about those lawsuits. I did also want to say that we have been in family team meetings when safety plans are being put together with an unsafe parent and a relative, and both the parent and the relative are coerced into agreeing to the safety plan. The parent is coerced because the agency threatens that if they don't agree to this safety plan, the agency will have to remove the child to foster care and that they don't want the child to, quote, go into the system. And they say the same thing to the relative. You don't want this child in the system, do you? They don't tell the parent or the relative that the relative could be the foster parent. So it's not going to be that the child's going to go to some place they don't know or live with someone they don't know. They don't tell either of them that there's financial and other supports associated with that. They don't tell either party that the whole goal of foster care is reunification with the parent. Instead, we've been in these meetings where the social workers or others in the room that are CFSA staff will tell a parent that if their child goes into foster care, it's very difficult to get the child out of foster care. And this is all in their effort to strong arm the parent to agreeing to the safety plan, because if the parent doesn't agree, then they're in a bad situation where they may have to remove. And they also strong arm the relative. If the relative has the audacity to say, well, you know, because we've told them that they can be the foster parent, to actually ask for that, then the relative is told, well, you just want the money, and if you don't want to care for this child, then just give the child back. So it's very disturbing and upsetting the way that the agency takes advantage of people that don't know what their rights are and twists everything, the facts and the law, to ensure that the agency can get the outcome that they want, which is that the child will go live informally with the relative and that everyone, in air quotes, agrees with that.
It is disturbing. I will say this, as a social worker, I heavily believe in trying to plan as much as we can with relatives and with families because we want to keep the family whole. But when you mix up that message to include a fear-based intervention, not a strength-based, that becomes extremely problematic. And when you're talking about families, a safety plan should be short-term. As a social worker, you're trying your best to make a viable safety plan where everyone can agree to the parameters of that safety plan. And when people can't agree to it, because if you can't get to the core of why someone's actions are the way they are, a safety plan is just a piece of paper. So if I conduct a safety plan and I don't actually believe anyone will adhere to it, I, as a social worker, have the duty to intervene on a different level than a safety plan. And when a safety plan is not viable, that's a removal. So that's what concerns me about the scenarios. But also, what you're doing is you're taking these very vulnerable children who you as an agency have already determined meets the criteria of immediate safety concern, which usually is something that is substantiated. Like, you have to be able to have a real code to that safety plan. You don't just safety plan around, well, you didn't have the type of cereal you wanted this morning. You safety plan around real items. So if a child needed to be safety planned with, that pretty much indicates there should be a substantiation for some type of abuse or neglect. When that substantiation takes place, the child is guaranteed protection by the government. And when the government creates these third-party illegal placements, it leaves the child vulnerable because there's no one watching that safety plan. One, two, there's no legal background. Like, I'm trying to keep the child safe. The legal caregiver or the parent comes to my house with the police and says, I want the child back. I have nothing other than the safety plan, which is not enforceable from a criminal level to keep the child. And I've even had caregivers threatened with kidnapping or harboring because of the fact they were trying to implement a safety plan that just was not a viable safety plan because they had no legal authority to implement it. So I think there's all sorts of secondary and tertiary impacts that can happen on the community, and it can be extremely exhausting when you think you're stepping in and doing the right thing on behalf of the child, but you have no resources. And the whole argument of, well, you just want the money, is really kind of silly because CFSA has a breakdown of what the money is supposed to be used for, and it's based off of federal guidelines. So everything is associated to buying clothes and food and all of those aspects of taking care of a child. So the money is coded to where it's supposed to be. So if we're saying to people, well, you're not taking care of the child and you just want the money, that's really a fallback or a reflection on the agency, because the agency should be ensuring that that money actually meets the child's needs every month and is part of the social worker's duty in the context of a larger case. So it's really negating the duty of the state, which is problematic.
And not only that, research shows that giving low-income families even a little bit more money can make a substantial difference in the life of that child, because they have access to food and stable housing, and it can impact them for the rest of their lives to be able to have that stability versus not. So what's so wrong with getting some extra support when you're taking on a responsibility that's not even yours in the first place to have?
Well, and it's not even extra. I think we need to shift our thinking about foster care stipends. It is akin to child support. And what we always say about child support is for the child. And if you find that that money is more than you need to support the needs of that child during that period of time, you can put that away for their future. Child welfare right now is so focused on the perpetrator and the rights of the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator that we forget this system is actually built to protect the child. And so the funds that are sent to foster homes are not for the foster parent, they are for the foster child and to support their needs. And just because they come from a lower income family doesn't negate, oh, well, they should still live in poverty now that we as a state has intervened. The state has a duty to provide equity, and that equity looks like a financial support. And so when we refuse that financial support to a child who's been abused or neglected, we as a system are perpetrating, and that's problematic.
What we're talking about is approximately $1,100 per month per child. So we're talking about roughly $13,000 a year.
Yeah. And what we have to remember is any child who's been deemed abused or neglected is going to have the need for support, whether it's just extra attention from a foster parent or visitation with relatives or mental health support or medical intervention. We're not talking about children who've never experienced trauma. I mean, essentially the definition of foster care is a child who has experienced some type of trauma and has been identified as abused or neglected. And given that definition, our foster parents, most of them are really honestly trying to do the right thing, and especially kinship when they step out and say, I really want to be of support. So if you're taking time off of work, if you're applying for FMLA, which you can do as a foster parent to be able to meet that child's needs, $1,100 a month or $13,000 a year doesn't usually compensate all the other pieces of travel and time and energy to include specialized needs. The child might come to you with no clothes whatsoever, and so you're not starting with a full wardrobe, you're starting with the clothes on their back. And so we have to really break that money down to recognize it's extremely insignificant and should not be used as a tactic to demonize people who have stepped forward to provide support for their family. It is just a very basic resource.
Totally agree with that. I actually promised our listeners that we would talk about missing documents today. So So maybe we could talk briefly about the missing documents that the Lashon Monitor identified with respect to the hotline calls and investigations in order to comply with the Lashon data points that they're required to only assign a certain number of cases for investigation per caseworker. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Did the monitor identify the type of documents that he felt were missing?
According to the transcript from the hearing in the Lashon federal lawsuit of May 16, 2018, plaintiff's counsel represented to the judge the following. In addition, something else that we're very concerned about is that for the second time in about 2 years, the monitor has been unable to validate caseload standards for investigation and family assessment. That has to do with the fact that it appears that there has been an effort to keep cases unassigned or assigned to supervisors so that the district can be in compliance with the caseload standards. There's a problem with the caseload standards in entry-level services. I was told by the monitor that there has been further conversation with CFSA. And you'll hear, I'm sure, from Ms. Donald today about what they're going to do about that. But this is the second time in 2 years, and that's wrong. And it's not the way things should be working at this stage in the case. Looking at the monitor report for the period July to December 2017 on page 65, the monitor reports as follows. During the month of December 2017, there was a range of 16 to 78 referrals each day designated as, quote, in transfer, meaning that the referral had been accepted at the hotline, it was designated as either an investigation or FA, and the referral was awaiting assignment to either a CPS investigator or FA worker. For example, on December 12, 2017, there were 78 referrals that were in transfer, and they had been in transfer for between 1 to 12 days. 64 of these referrals were awaiting assignment to an FA worker, and 14 were awaiting assignment to an investigative worker. Of the 78 in transfer referrals, almost half, 46%, had been in transfer for more than 2 days. Specifically, 12 were in transfer for between 2 and 4 days, and 24 were in transfer for 5 to 12 days. Additionally, on December 12th, 6 referrals were assigned to a CPS supervisor. 5, which is 83%, were assigned to the supervisor for between 5 and 28 days. The high number of referrals in transfer for more than 5 days between December 7th and December 14th raises concerns. The monitor is concerned that supervisors are being directly and indirectly influenced to hold referrals or place them in transfer status, in part due to directives that their workers should not have a caseload with more than 12 referrals, which would be out of compliance with the Lashon standard. If the referrals were appropriately and more timely assigned to a worker, performance on the Lashon caseload standard would almost certainly have been lower than reported.
Maybe you can explain how that could happen and why that's a problem.
So there's different official names for it. I testified in front of DC City Council about the same issue. And from the worker perspective, it was called disappearing cases. And from the management perspective, they had given it the name of strategic assignments. What was happening was there was a data poll on the last day of every month to determine how many cases were in a worker's box. It was well known that the data poll ran at midnight. So what they would do is they would hand out investigations the day of. So the day of assignment, it would be the last day of the month, and say I already had 14 cases, but they had 2 more investigations with nowhere to go, other people had called out sick, or everyone's at 14, so it really didn't matter who it went to, right? So they would hand me the paper assignment. And in that paper assignment, I'd go out and initiate the case. But then I was, as a worker, looking for it in my box because within minutes of assignment, it should be dropped into my box so that I could actually enter my notes. And so workers would notice that their assigned cases weren't in their boxes, so they would just go, as a CPS worker, you can type in the referral number, you can get access to it, and you can put in your notes that way. So they would call them disappearing cases. Sometimes they would trace the case to another social worker's box who had lower case counts but had not been assigned it, usually within the same unit. But most often what was happening is, per Lashon, supervisors can't have cases in their boxes because they're not case carrying. So what the agency was doing was allowing those cases to sit in the electronic box of the supervisor during case count times. And you could obviously see that it was assigned to the social worker, that eventually it was moved to their box later on. So for instance, what I had done would take screenshots of the assignment list on one screen so you can see where the tracking of where the investigation sat. So you can see the timestamp of who moved it, where they moved it, to what box, what day old it was, things of that nature. And then you could take a screenshot of the contacts. And then what you would realize is that the social worker who eventually was assigned had put in contacts on the day of assignment, but the investigative report had bounced around management's boxes until either one of their cases were closed or the data run had taken place. I would present these time snaps to the director of the agency, and then I presented it to the quality assurance saying, I knew about this practice when I was down in Child Protective Services because I spent a good bit of time there, but I never allowed anyone to move the investigations from my box. And so when I left Child Protective Services, I questioned the 100% mark of CPS numbers because I thought, well, that's really interesting. Now that I'm out of the administration, all of a sudden, despite caseloads not changing, they're at 100% for case count compliance and investigations, and I questioned it. And then through this process of the whistleblowing, I actually sat down with the monitor and reiterated, this is still happening. This is what I'm hearing from people inside. And here's the information about what was happening back then. Obviously, I've not been kept in the loop as to the findings, but it's interesting to hear that that was validated later on. It's actually been validated a couple times over a series of years. So even when I was at the agency, they found some problems. And my understanding is currently case counts are pretty low given the pandemic, so I would really hope it's not happening. But another way to hide case count numbers is to enter it into the system as an information and referral, so it doesn't have allegations in it, it doesn't have safety plans in it, and technically I and R's don't fit in people's boxes. So there's a couple of ways to hide case count numbers. You can also choose not to count links as part of that case count number, because sometimes you have families that are a chronic issue and, you know, we got a call on Tuesday, we got a call on Friday, we got a call on Sunday. Technically, the worker is going out three times, making three sets of assessments, but it's in the box, it looks like one. You don't actually see the workload. And that was the problem historically. I don't know if it's a current issue, though.
And that's a wrap of Episode 11 of the DC KinCare Alliance podcast. Tune in next time when Marie Cohen returns to discuss the internal child fatality review report from the Child and Family Services Agency. See you next time.